Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Item number one as we get going today. For Pete's sake, people, do not click on links and emails you're not sure of, will you? Item number two, you can't get a bottle of water on a plane, but you can get $50 million in diamonds off of one. And number three, who are these guys, Simpson and Bowles? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 19th of February. Good as always to have you with us. All right, so as if the trade gap and outsourcing and intellectual property and them owning so much of our national debt and all the rest of it wasn't enough, the New York Times told us this morning that the Chinese army is getting really, really good at hacking our computers. The paper cites a study by a security firm known as Mandiant that says a whole slew of Chinese intrusions into corporate networks in this country, and quite possibly infrastructure computer systems as well, can be traced to a Chinese army unit in Shanghai. Kim Zetter is a senior reporter at Wired magazine. She covers cybersecurity for him. Kim, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
First things first, is this as bad as it seems? Not the stealing the recipe for, you know, Coca-Cola, but the whole infrastructure and water plants and power grids and all of that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, these hacks have been going on for a while, and they're getting, you know, more and more targeted and systematic. And one of the things that this report is trying to do is just to shine a spotlight on that to make people aware of, you know, really how intensive this activity is.
Would you go so far as to use the word scary?
No, I don't like to use that term. I mean, this is espionage. This is espionage, and a lot of it is economic espionage. You know, in the past, it's happened in other ways. You know, it just the cyber and computers just makes it a lot easier and a lot more stealth.
How do these guys get in? I mean, it looks a lot like it's all email based now, right?
Yeah, it's very easy to get in through email because you have a lot of protections on a network, but you can't block email from coming in. And so what happens is they send out targeted spear phishing attacks, which is essentially an email that's crafted in a way that it's going to entice an employee to open it. It can come from someone that the employee knows so that they're more likely to open it, or it's about a topic that they're really interested in. And so they either open the attachment that's connected to the email or click on a link that takes them to a malicious website, and that allows malware to get installed on their system. And then the attackers use that employee system as a, sort of a pivot point to dig further into the network.
Okay, but wait a minute. Don't we all know by now, and haven't the IT guys at all of our various offices made it clear by now that if you don't know who an email is from, you don't click on the link?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, employees, it's been drilled into them not to open emails. But there was a case a couple of years ago where RSA, a computer security firm, was hacked. And in that case, an email was sent to about four employees. And in one of the cases, the email actually went into the employee's trash can. And the employee went into the trash can to retrieve the email because it looked so interesting to him. And then he opened it. So you can take all the measures to make sure that, you know, employees don't do something and they're still going to do it.
Huh. Talk to me for a second about this company, Mandiant. Did they just do this report out of the goodness of their own hearts and then share it with the New York Times to get some publicity? Is that how this security sort of business development model works?
Well, Mandiant publishes a lot of reports. So this is one that's getting a lot of attention in the mainstream media. Their previous reports haven't gotten any attention at all outside of the computer security community. But computer security companies often publish white papers. They publish, you know, scrubbed reports about investigations that they've handled without identifying victims and things like that. In this case, they've gone the extra step, though, in pointing a finger very directly at China and laying out all of the circumstantial evidence for why they believe the Chinese military and the Chinese Communist Party are behind these attacks. And that's something that we haven't really seen before.
Kim Zetter, she's a senior reporter at Wired, talks about cybersecurity a lot. Kim, thanks a bunch.
You're welcome.
On Wall Street today, I'll just leave you with this, folks. If the Dow gains another 0.9% or so tomorrow, we are back in the land of all-time highs. Discuss amongst yourselves. And in the meantime, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. I was going to set up this next story about the sequester, the budget cuts coming at the end of the month, with a piece of tape from President Obama today. He did one of those get a bunch of regular citizens on a set of risers behind him and make a speech things this morning, trying to convince Congress to do something about the sequester. Anyway, I was listening along, trying to figure out what part of it might be good to play for you. Most of it was pretty boilerplate politic, in truth be told, so I'd just about given up when he got to this.
This is not an abstraction. There are people whose livelihoods are at stake. There are communities that are going to be impacted in a negative way.
That is absolutely true at the center of the sequester universe in Washington, D.C., where a whole lot of people are starting to get nervous. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer discovered they are everywhere she goes.
We're a strange breed here in Washington, a city of geeks. We follow the lurchings of Congress like normal people follow their favorite baseball team. We kind of have to. Government is the biggest game in town, but now it's getting ridiculous. Sequester stress is seeping into every corner of my life. I decided to drag my tape recorder around for a couple of days to give you a taste of it. My day usually begins with a caffeine fix in the kitchen down the hall from the Marketplace Bureau. There's a cluster of offices around the kitchen. I've got a number of kitchen buddies.
Hello.
Hi, Nancy.
One of them is Jennifer Lockman.
How are you?
Good. You've got your coffee.
Yep.
So let's go into your office.
Great.
Jennifer is executive director of the U.S. branch of a nonprofit called MAG, which stands for Mines Advisory Group. They remove mines and surplus weapons from war-torn countries. Jennifer's office gets 95% of its funding from the State Department. If the sequester hits, the State Department's budget would be cut by around 5%. Jennifer Lockman knows that could filter down to her.
It is one of the most stress-inducing situations that I've ever faced at work.
Jennifer says her staff is banding together to fight the stress, going out to more happy hours and maybe throwing an extra cocktail into the mix. Other sequester sufferers have different ways to cope. At lunchtime, I head out to some downtown food trucks. I meet Deanna Collins. She works at a law firm. It depends on government contracts, which could be cut by the sequester, causing a wave of layoffs. Collins is very worried. She's smoking more. I ask how much more.
Before everything started to kind of fall apart, about a pack a week, I'm maybe now to a pack every 3 days.
Other people I talk to are trying to tune out the sequester buzz. Shelley Goldsban works for a medical research firm. Some of that research is government funded. She feels powerless to stop the sequester.
So I've just sort of given up and sort of just am sitting on the sidelines with the bowl of popcorn, watching everything go down in a flaming ball of death.
Okay, then. Maybe it's time to move on. Maybe things will be different once I leave work for the day. My neighbors are having a potluck. Hopefully they're not on a sequester death watch. No such luck. There's the usual talk of real estate, but with a sequester tinge. My neighbor Sterling Merring is a realtor. He says the Washington market has been red hot lately. He even made a few sales over the holidays, but now he's worried about a sequester slump.
You know, I just know how fragile the market is. It can stop on a dime.
At that point, my husband and I head home with our twin toddlers, who are just about the only people in my world not talking about the sequester. And that's only because they can't say the word.
Buster, Buster.
Unfortunately, they do eventually master it.
Sequester! Sequester! Sequester!
Then they want to know more. As in any toddler sequester interrogation, one word is repeated over and over.
Why?
Which actually is a very good question.
Why?
In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Why? All right, continuing with the theme here, we now bring you the second episode of Simpson Bowles, two unelected men with a plan to cut the budget deficit. Today's installment consists of another $2.5 trillion worth of austerity. It's a sequel to the less-than-well-received original Simpson Bowles National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, to call it by its official name. But really, why does anybody in official Washington listen to these guys anyway? Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The dynamic fiscal duo is Democrat Erskine Bowles and Republican Alan Simpson. They ran a budget commission 3 years ago, spit out a report, which went on a shelf. Yet they're still in the middle of our deficit conversation. Why? Clint Stretch, a tax analyst, says they insert themselves in it. And their plan is in the political middle, Goldilocks, in a city of very hard beds and very soft ones.
Simpson-Bowles comes down essentially on the side of saying government ought to be bigger than Republicans would have it be, and probably smaller than Democrats would have it be.
In the campaign, both candidates cited Simpson-Bowles favorably. And many economists dig it, says one very famous one. Harvard's Kenneth Rogoff says Simpson-Bowles kills the right tax breaks, and it doesn't raise taxes so much that it stalls growth.
I think still the original proposal they put out there is sort of the light post by which policymakers will try to guide themselves over the longer term, at least we hope so.
It's not the North Star to everyone. Simpson and Bowles are urgent about deficit cutting, but Henry Aaron at the Brookings Institution says the bigger problem is millions unemployed.
That's the primary waste we have today. Ending that waste should be job one. Job two is dealing with our longer-term budget challenges.
This view tolerates more government borrowing and spending, but the gospel of Simpson and Bowles is to push deficits just one way, down. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The Daytona 500 is coming up this weekend. Danica Patrick won the first competition of the premier race on the NASCAR calendar. She'll be on the pole when the race starts on Sunday, followed, by the way, by 42 other drivers hot on her heels who would like nothing better than to win that race themselves. But, you know, it's not just in sports that we compete. It happens in the office and the classroom as well. Poe Bronson is the co-author of a new book on that topic. It's called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai. I appreciate it.
How did you get interested in this? I mean, this isn't your everyday, pick up a book and browse it off the shelves kind of thing.
You know, Kai, I didn't tell a lot of people. About 3 years ago, I had a total hip replacement on my left leg and several unsuccessful surgeries.
That's kind of shocking because, I mean, you're a young guy, so that's...
Yeah, and I had a lot of setbacks in my rehab, and I was a big athlete and everything still, and it was affecting my whole life. It was affecting my writing work. I was kind of losing my edge. And reading all this research and being soaked up in the minutiae of competing gave me the zeal again to tackle big challenges. And I think more than any particular point, that's what I hope the book does for some readers. I think about the people who are no longer looking for jobs or the people who are feeling overwhelmed by the inability to pay their mortgage. And just to restore people's sense of being eager to go out there and compete every day.
Well, but play that out a little bit. What makes one guy sitting on the Metro North train into Manhattan different from the guy sitting next to him on that same train in competitiveness?
One important factor is genetic. We all know that there are some people who seem to really do great on a daily basis as long as they're not stressed out. But once they get a lot of stress on them, they kind of melt down. While there are other people, they need a deadline. They need to perform. And when all that stress happens, they perform their best. But other biological factors, such as prenatal testosterone, affects your lifelong hormonal response to challenge.
Is there a point at which sort of pseudo-mastery becomes a little bit dangerous? Can you master competition in whatever your chosen field is to the point where you know enough but you don't know that you don't know enough? You know, if that makes any sense?
Being great at something can sort of backfire because you're overconfident.
Yeah, you get cocky,
and then actually
right?
being slightly underconfident wires up the mind to have this sort of critical thinking. You're looking ahead for strategic things that you can do, and you ready your whole body. You get a testosterone response in the 24 hours beforehand. You get a lot of neurotransmitter buildup. That all comes into play once the performance or the competition starts.
But here's the thing, right? I mean, doesn't competition in a way give you permission to behave badly? I mean, there's that saying, you know, you ain't cheating, you ain't trying, man. You know?
I totally disagree, Kai. You know, I don't know if you're trying to bait me there, but honestly, you can be super competitive and have no proclivity to cross that line.
Is it okay that life is competitive?
I think it's, the question is not just that it's okay. The question is, can we learn to embrace it? You can learn to actually enjoy the stress and intensity of competition and actually miss it when it's not happening in your life. And you can actually get competitive advantages by enjoying the stress rather than being freaked out by it.
Poe Bronson is with Ashley Merriman, the author of a new book on competition. It's called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Poe, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai. I really appreciate it.
Coming up, immigration reform, a case study.
When I first got my paycheck, I was very surprised at how much I received and how much a difference just having that work permit made.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 53 points today, 0.4%, closed at 14,035. The NASDAQ charged up 21 points, 2/3%. Wrapped up at 3213. The S&P 500 added 11 points, 0.7%. Finished at 1530. Office Max piled up a 20% gain today. Office Depot stacked up 9% after the two big box stores announced a merger. But honestly, didn't you think they were the same company already? Come on. Google pulled in 1.75% today, the first time that company's share price has topped $800 a piece. Apple was flat today. Cisco Systems engineered a 2.25% rise. General Electric clicked up nearly 2% today. Humana unplugged 6.33% today. That after the government came out with Medicare reimbursement rates that were lower than expected. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.02%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for January. The United Nations marks World Day of Social Justice. And St. Louis gets a little brighter. The 150-foot Budweiser sign illuminating the flagship Anheuser-Busch brewery is due to be plugged back in after renovation. It's more energy efficient. Now everyone, just go back to making beer. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. To paraphrase Willie Sutton's line about why he robbed banks, I suppose one robs airplanes because that's where the diamonds are. Brute force and blinding speed were the keys to that heist in Brussels, Belgium this morning. Thieves disguised as police broke through the airport fence, grabbed what could be $50 million in diamonds from a plane getting ready to go, and then they were out of there. Whether they'll see anything like the full $50 million, though, is doubtful because, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London, diamonds may not be the thieves' best friend.
The diamonds were being shipped through Brussels from nearby Antwerp, hub of the global diamond trade. Caroline de Wolf of the Antwerp World Diamond Centre says the chances are these stones will never be recovered.
The possibility that they will be sold by the burglars is a very big possibility. And it is obviously a product that is also quite easily to transport.
They're rough diamonds and should carry a certificate under the Kimberley process, a system to eliminate so-called blood diamonds that finance armed conflicts. But Annie Dunnerback of the human rights group Global Witness says the process is not totally effective.
Places like Dubai and the United Arab Emirates tend to have weaker controls and less government oversight, so that might be an easier place to dispose of these diamonds.
Even so, it could be very time-consuming. Fred Quaylar is author of How to Buy a Diamond and has himself had a brush with the law. He says the thieves will need to trickle the diamonds into the market.
They would take one or two stones and mix them in together with stuff that was not stolen and then slowly disperse them that particular way.
There are other possibilities. The stolen diamonds could become a kind of criminal currency used to finance the trade in illegal drugs and weapons. But however they're disposed of, Quaylar says the robbers should not expect a dazzling return.
3 to 4% is what the initial thief is probably going to get on the parcel. Everybody else will be in the supply chain.
Divide that between the eight people who staged the raid and the haul begins to look rather more modest.
Oh, they'd be lucky to get a few hundred thousand.
Meanwhile, Antwerp is counting the cost to its reputation as a safe, secure and discreet diamond centre. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I don't know if this is a rule in the ad industry, but if it's not, maybe it ought to be. When all else fails, bring back the oldies and the goodies. On the Oscars this weekend, Kraft is going to spend almost $2 million on this.
Pardon me, would you have any Grey Poupon?
But of course.
Because it turns out selling mustard is a lot harder now than it was 30 years ago, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains.
Mustard has a marketing problem.
It's just one simple flavor.
Matthew Hudak is a food analyst with the market research firm Euromonitor.
Current taste, especially for younger consumers, is, you know, something more interesting, something more bold. And, I mean, bold and interesting don't always go hand in hand with mustard.
Hudak says over the past 5 years, consumption of the yellow stuff is down by about 2.5%. Part of the problem has been the war on carbs. People are eating fewer sandwiches, and hot sauce is on the rise. I took a quick trip to a grocery store in North Philly and could see how mustard is trying to keep up with its condiment cousin. You've got roasted habanero, horseradish, wasabi sauce, New York deli style, Texas chili, mango, smoky chipotle. You get the idea. One thing Grey Poupon has going for it, says Hudak, is the past.
Playing on nostalgia, playing on what you remember when you were younger, has been working well for a lot of other companies.
The challenge for Grey Poupon is making two elitists driving around in Rolls Royces as interesting as Sriracha or Louisiana hot sauce. That's just a shelf away. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Immigration probably runs a close second to the sequester as a topic of conversation in Washington nowadays. And in fact, there was some public back and forth on that topic this weekend about a White House plan to let undocumented immigrants become citizens within 8 years. The GOP pushed back, so the White House backed off. But for all the uncertainty that does still surround immigration, about 150,000 immigrants who were brought here illegally as children did get some security last year with a program called Deferred Action. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler profiles two of them.
Soy un buzo muy curioso.
At this dual-language kindergarten class in Los Angeles, substitute teacher Miguel Carvente instructs the kids in English and Spanish. In some ways, he's also teaching by example. He came to this country from Mexico when he was 5. Carvente didn't even think about his legal status until he got older.
It sort of hit me when I realized that a lot of things were being closed to me because I lacked certain documentation.
After high school, he worked a variety of menial jobs, sewing clothes in a garment factory, stocking shelves in a liquor store, all paid under the table.
It paid way below minimum wage, and so that was sort of something you aspired to earn minimum wage.
He managed to put himself through UCLA and got a teaching credential, but then his career hit a roadblock.
The majority of my peers were applying for jobs and visiting schools. It's sort of disheartening to know that they're getting a job somewhere. I knew that I was just as qualified as they were.
Last fall, he got a break when the government granted him deferred action. So for the next 2 years, he won't face deportation and can work here legally. Now Carvente gets paid around $150 to teach for 4 hours.
When I first got my paycheck from the first few days here, I was very surprised at how much I received and how much a difference just having that work permit made in terms of your earning power.
Can I help you?
Can you see Mr. Esparza? So he can help me with...
Across town, 20-year-old Ariane Nava was equally thrilled to get her first check, $307.
It was just such a sense of relief that I no longer had to do it under the table, that it was no longer illegal for me to work.
She's a student at Los Angeles Trade Technical College. For the last 3 months, she's worked as a receptionist at the college, helping people who want to transfer to a 4-year university.
Do you guys offer a scholarship?
We are offering 2 scholarships right now.
So before she got this job, she struggled to pay the tuition of $460 a semester. Remember, at that point, she was legally barred from working.
Before, it was just really, really difficult to even study for a test and know that I might not even get the actual grade because I didn't have the money to pay for that class.
Nava is grateful for the chance to join the ranks of the documented workforce, but she still worries about her parents, who live under constant threat of deportation. And her reprieve is only temporary.
It is only for 2 years. That's the scary part.
Surveying his kindergarten class, 28-year-old Miguel Carvente also wonders how long his good luck will last. The Deferred Action Program only covers people under the age of 31. The current rules allow people like him who have already qualified to apply for an extension, but nothing's written in stone.
So that's my biggest worry, that I'll be 31 and I'll suddenly be out of the program and sort of be stuck back where I started a few years ago.
Until then, he's in legal limbo. Along with more than 100,000 other young immigrants who've been granted deferred action, Carvente is unsure if his economic future will be bright or a return to the shadows. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This final note today in which you get something for nothing. Dig around in your house and find out how many old mobile phones you have sitting around there, and then sell them. The website SellSell, that's S first, C second, did a survey. And yes, they do have a vested interest here, but they figure the average American has $171 worth of old cell phones stuffed in drawers someplace. Off the top of my head, I think we've got five in my house. I don't know. All told, comes to $33 billion in old phones, which is crazy. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow up 53 points, 0.4%. Look out tomorrow if it goes up. The NASDAQ charged up 21 points, 0.2%. CNBC is going to be all over it, right? The S&P 500 added 11.7%. Now, I have good friends who work at CNBC. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.